And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to The Full 60 featuring Craig Custance and presented by The Athletic. Each week, we'll dive into the biggest stories in hockey while bringing in unique voices to entertain and explain all aspects of the game.
Hey, this is Craig, and welcome to this week's episode of The Full 60. And I'm already smiling because we started telling stories before record, and then we're like, hey, let's just hit the record button and do this, and we can share the stories with you guys. I am thrilled to have James Duffy, of course, of TSN, also the author. His latest book is called Beauties, Hockey's Greatest Untold Stories. And first of all, James, welcome. Thanks for doing this.
Well, thanks for having me, bud.
I want to say, first and foremost, before we get into a couple of things we're talking about, what I loved about this book, and maybe it's just because of my time covering the league, is we're starting to enter this time where the stories of the current athletes are being told. Like, it seemed like before it was like, hey, here's all these great books about people from like the 70s or whatever. And it's, that's fine. But it's way more fun to me as a hockey fan and somebody in the, you know, covering the game right now, to here's a great story you've never heard from, you know, Connor McDavid or Austin Matthews. I love that. Like that really made this fun.
Well, thank you. And it's become harder and harder to do, I think. That's part of it is, and you're right, you know, most hockey books about stuff from the 80s, 90s, 60s, beyond. And there are a few stories like that. Obviously, I'm going to write this book. I wanted stories about Wayne Gretzky and Brett Hull and some of those guys. But it's harder and harder, I think, to get guys to tell stories like that. And, you know, in general, the retired player tells a better story anyway because he feels freed from the bounds of everything. But I was really genuinely surprised by guys like Crosby and McDavid and so on, that when, once you get them away from those intermission interviews and get pucks deep and all that crap, they have a lot of great stories to tell. Yeah. And I don't know, Craig, it's something about hockey, I think, that just lends itself to really good stories. And thanks for saying that, because you're right. You know, I think it's, you need to hear more from a guy like Austin Matthews than just a couple of picks.
For sure. And it's, that's right. And you know, it's, as somebody who like cares about the sport, cares about the promotion of the sport, it is, too often we get these guys, like you said, buttoned up and trying not to say the right and wrong thing. And to see their personalities, like especially Connor, like I think Connor sometimes gets criticized, and I think fairly, because he does tend to be play things close to the vest. I've talked to him, I've been interviewing him since, you know, he was 15, 16, like you have, and right. I've seen the side of him that you got in this book, where he's laughing and he's telling good stories, and there's a comfort level there that I think it's great for hockey fans to see that.
I truly think that everybody, no matter how quiet or reserved or boring you think a guy is, that they all have stories within them. Like they've all, you know, if you've played hockey for your entire life and, you know, been through the juniors or college or the NHL for a couple of years, even if the stories aren't about you, you have stories. You have stories from the room or the road or whatever. So it's just a matter of getting it out of them.
Yeah. I remember the first time I went and talked to Connor McDavid, he was playing for Erie, and they had, I'm sure people remember from Twitter, they had to like wear this crazy suit if they were the player of the game. And, you know, poor Connor comes out as a kid wearing, it was like something out of a comic book. And I remember talking and then seeing afterwards, he does that, and he's just completely like, you know, humble about it, whatever. And then he's carrying the hockey bags of all his teammates out to the bus. I was just kind of hanging out in the hallway talking to the coaches or whatever. There's no other media there. And I see him just grabbing bags. And they're like, I'm like, you knew at that point, like there was 10 GMs in the stands talking about how this is the next superstar. There was no secret about it. And he was doing that. And I just love, and I talked to the coach, she's like, yeah, that's he's a first year player on this team. And this is first year players got to carry the bags. And I'm like, that's great.
And one of my favorite, you know, Connor tells us a couple of great stories in the book, but Teddy Purcell, who's one of my favorites, tells a story about Connor showing up his first year in Edmonton when Purcell was there with his Erie Otters bag for the road, you know, the bag that you keep your suits in. And, you know, Teddy had been through this himself in Tampa where he didn't know anything, a boy from Newfoundland, and got lectured by Vinny LeCavalier and these guys saying, no, you have to get, you know, a nice, whatever it be, Gucci bag, and completely lecturing the face of hockey and Connor McDavid saying, you're going to go out and you're going to spend a couple of grand to get yourself a nice bag. and then going to buy him a watch, saying, once he got him a bag, he said, I have to buy you a watch. And, you know, these players buy $4,000 or $5,000 watches. And so he sets him up for a watch and then, says, okay, you need, you know, I need whatever it is, $4,000 or $5,000 or $6,000 or whatever the watch is. And Connor's like, I don't have a, you know, I don't have a checking account or a credit card. He said, buddy, you're going to make about $100 million
the next 10 years. You might be trying to set up the business account.
It's time to get that.
but I'm always amused at how, I don't want to say unprepared. I don't want this to be so negative, but like just... The players are so immersed in their world, right, where they don't have to handle something like, you know, opening a can of tuna or something that we learn at an early age. And one of my favorite versions of that is I went down to Tampa when Steven Stamkos got drafted, and he or somebody in the team was telling, like, he had realized he had no way to email, no way to communicate, so he went to buy a laptop and didn't know how to get it. Was like randomly walking around this giant busy street in Tampa, like the busiest street, you know, almost, you know, lost, just trying to buy a laptop. And it was this, you know, he's like, it just took an entire day. And, you know, like,
well, I heard a story about Jeff Skinner when he was in Carolina, and I don't know if it was his parents or his roommate, but he was just sticking his checks in his drawer. He didn't have direct deposit from the Hurricanes. And so somebody came to his house and found, you know, whatever it would be for his first year, $500,000 worth of uncashed checks.
No way.
Yeah. He was just living off the per diem or whatever. So, yeah, I think you're right. And the best agents now, you know, have people that guide these guys through life skills. But you're right. You have to remember they're, you know, a lot of them are plucked out of their homes and off the junior at 16 or 17, and then off to the NHL a couple years later, and they haven't learned some of the base. Heck, I haven't learned some of the basic life skills, so I can't even imagine them.
Oh, man. So, like, here we are, 5 seconds in, we're swapping stories. Like, there's a million of these in the hockey world, and and you're right, it is people are guarded, they don't want it out, or they'll tell you the story, and they'll say, this is not for publication, like, this will never hear the latest. So, you know, the even better stories are those. Right. So, what was your strategy in, A, convincing people to let you share these? Because like you said, this wasn't like 30 years ago I did this. This was, hey, you know, I hung up on Taylor Hall. How was that process? And then how did you settle on the stories you ended up telling?
Well, I didn't have a strategy, first of all, Craig. I had none. As a good author, I sat down and had no strategy whatsoever, except that I was just going to try. And with each individual, it worked a different way. I mean, I think in... The idea for the book came from sitting on that panel for 20 years, and we've had so many different guest players or coaches or whatever. And as you know, they often tell you the best stories not on the air, right? When we're sitting around having pizza or whatever. And so I guess for several years now, in the back of my head, I was thinking, you know, and not just because they're too salacious for TV necessarily, but they don't fit the format of TV, right? And I think that's where Spittin' Chiclets has been so successful, because it fits the format of a podcast, having a guy on and talking for 45 minutes, but I hadn't really seen it done in a book. So, you know, for the most part, I think guys were generally comfortable. You know, a lot of the guys I work with, the Jamie McLennans and Dave Poulins and Jeff O'Neills and such, you know, they've told the story. So that was no problem. With the current players, I had no idea what I was going to get. I really didn't. And I was just hoping for the best, frankly. And if I had got somebody on the phone and they told me a story that wasn't great, then I would just kind of go, as I'm sure you've done in countless interviews, do you got anything else? I guess, you know, there's a level of trust where most of the people in the book I had some sort of degree of relationship with before. Sure. Anjay Kopitar starred in one of the goofy TSN features we did, where we did a parody of The Hangover, and so I've known Anjay for I've known him for a long time, so he trusted me. And Sid, though I don't pretend to be close to, I guess I've interviewed enough times that he trusted me. And I've told the story a couple of times, but Sid actually, it's the bigger thing was getting a hold of these guys during a playoff run. As you know, getting a guy for an hour, 2 hours on the phone is a real challenge. And in Sid's case, he would send me voice memos, which every couple of weeks, a voice memo would pop up on my phone. And I don't know where Sid was, on a plane or in a car or waiting for a flight somewhere. And he'd say, "Hey, James, I thought of another one for you." These would come up once in a while. And in the end, I had about 10 great Sid stories. So I was really happy that, you know, they trusted me. Obviously, the book, there's going to be no TMZ. There's some really interesting things in the book that I think people have never heard of. Like you say, McDavid hanging up on Taylor Hall when he calls to congratulate him. But there's nothing, you know, there's no real, you know, strip joint lap dance kind of stories in there. And I wanted everybody to be happy with the book. I wanted them to read their chapter and not go, "Oh my gosh, I've gotten myself in trouble," right? There was a couple of people that called back and said, "Hey, do you mind taking out this line or whatever?" But I think that happened really like maybe twice in the entire book.
Yeah, that's always the line you walk, right? With something like this, they're helping you out on some level. I mean, they are, without a doubt. So you don't want, but you also are like this can't be some sterilized version of reality either. So,
in certain cases, I would say, look, if I can't tell the story right, then we're just not going to put that story in or whatever, right? But you know, it wasn't. This was a different. You know, I guess some of the rules that I would have been taught in journalism school. I think in a book like this, you have to break. I'm not going to just take the story and print it 100% without saying, "Hey, Sid, are you all right if I use this one?" You know, that kind of thing. Because I think that's part of. I wanted the book to be, if Craig and I were sitting in a bar with this particular player or coach or whatever, and he's telling us stories. So I want it to be their stories. And so they have to be comfortable with it.
Right. And I don't think that, I mean, maybe Bob Woodward would disagree with this or whatever. I don't think that breaks down any walls of journal. Like, I don't think you're not doing your job. Part of it is maintaining sources' trust. And so when you do say, "Hey, okay, I'm going to publication here, or I've written it, I want to make sure you feel good about this," like that's maintaining a trust of the source so you can then relay those stories to fans. Like, I agree.
And, you know, there would be my more awkward conversations were ones I wanted. Look, there's a fish story element to hockey stories, as we know. Sure. And as I write in the book, if there's a little bit of embellishment in here, that's fine, because I want there to be. But I wanted the stories to be real. And because there's some, and, you know, there were a couple of people I interviewed where they told me stories, and then I did fact check as much as I possibly could. And I would find out they weren't true, or that didn't happen, or that wasn't that game. And so the more awkward conversations would be calling back and saying, "Hey, so you know that story, that actually didn't happen." It only happened a couple of times, but, you know, sometimes people just got dates wrong or opponents wrong or whatever. But I remember one particular chapter, and I won't say who it was. There was three or four major factual errors where I had to call back and say, "Yeah, that just didn't quite happen that way."
And sometimes it's not even malicious, right? Like I ran into that where it's like, you know, tell your best Joel Quenneville story, and they're like, "Oh yeah, it was this day." And three or four people tell this incredible story that kind of is the same, but you know, the
memories
third period was
play,
the first period.
You know, yeah, memories play, and there's some of these, you know, again, a lot of the stories were recent, but some of them are 20, 25 years old. So, heck, if I was telling you a story from, not that anybody would want to hear my own stories from 25 years ago, I'm sure I'd get facts wrong. So.
Yeah,
that
or make yourself look better. I would at least.
Definitely.
Everything would be like 10 times.
Oh, 100%.
I laugh because I, and first of all, I'm glad to see it's doing well. Like I've seen, you know, you tweeted out, you're like, hey, if it's sold on an Amazon, go to Indigo. I as a hockey writer and lover of the sport, I love to see the enthusiasm behind it. But I laugh because you were saying earlier before you hit the record button, that's led to some issues with you because you want to give copies to people that helped you.
Well, you know this, but for the listeners who don't know the publishing industry, when you sign a contract for a book, you know, one of the deals is you'll get 50 copies or 25 copies, or I think in my case, it was 100 copies. I knew that I wanted to send everybody who took taken the time to cooperate with me for the book, I was going to send them a copy of the book. And by the way, it's really weird signing an autographed copy of a book to say Wayne Gretzky or Sidney Crosby, because it's just like, why are you signing your autograph and sending it to Wayne Gretzky, you know, when he's going to use it as a coaster? But anyway, so I was sending out copies galore when I received my shipment, and HarperCollins was good enough to send me 100 copies, and they were gone in a heartbeat because I interviewed so many people for the book. And then your friends start coming around and everybody wants a free copy, and suddenly I had no copies. So HarperCollins were kind enough to send me another batch of like 25, and then they were gone. And then this weekend I had to go home just to drop off gifts for in-laws and parents and stuff for Christmas, and I had no copies of my book left. And so I had to go out and buy my own book, which is the most embarrassing thing ever. So two things happen. First, I go to a Chapters that has the book, and I buy like three copies of the book. And I'm wearing my mask, thank goodness. But the guy behind the counter recognizes me. And I'm sitting there with three copies of my own book. And he goes, isn't this you? Isn't? And I just go, yeah, please just take the Visa. Take the Visa. Move this out of here.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, your name's on the Visa too, by the
right.
way.
Right. So I do that, and then we need, okay, my wife says, okay, I need a couple more for Cousin Ernie or whatever. Yeah. So now I gotta try and get three more. And sorry, this sounds like a braggadocious, I'm not trying to be, but you're right. Just happened to be that a few of the stores around me were sold out. And so I go to a Costco, my neighborhood Costco, because I heard they were there, but I couldn't find any there. And as I was so I'm literally perusing through the piles of books at Costco, and I can't find my book. And at the exact time, there's this couple, and they're kind of looking for this book, and there's an employee across the aisle, and they go, do you have James Duthie's book, Beauties? And I'm standing right there, like, and it was the most awkward, embarrassing thing ever, because what am I supposed to say? Hi, by the way, that's me.
Bought the last 10 copies.
I'm right
sorry.
Here in the Costco, also looking for my book. And I ran out of the store so quickly because I just turned and ran because I was so embarrassed. I don't know. It was just, it's the strangest thing ever. So if anybody has any books I can buy off them, that would be awesome.
Yeah, the secondary market.
I should tell people, yeah. As the one shameless plug, you can buy the books online, and at a lot of the Chapters, just didn't happen to have them at the Chapters in Costco in my neighborhood.
Oh, that's great. Anything left on the cutting room floor that you were sad you weren't able to get in?
No. Yes and no. Definitely a few, but the thing that made me the happiest is that I did not leave anybody out who I talked to. So the 57 stories in this book are the there's probably 65 people I talked to or whatever, because sometimes there's two people in a chapter. There are stories that I left out from particular people. You know, Matt Nichol, the trainer, one of my favorite chapters is about Ray Emery, and not about Ray's death, but about Ray's comeback, which I think was really sort of, Dan Robson wrote a great piece about Ray, but and touched on it, but a story just about his comeback, which to me is one of the most remarkable comebacks in hockey history. And Matty Nichol tells that story, the trainer who helped him come back. But Matt had told me a great story about Eddie Belfour and orange juice, and how when Matt was the trainer with the Leafs, Eddie Belfour was obsessed with orange juice and this certain, I think it was Tropicana, with like Tropicana no pulp or whatever. Right. And he had to have this supply at all times. And Matt was in a constant panic that there would not be enough orange juice. And Matt tells this great story about a playoff game where he had to run out in the middle of a playoff game to buy Tropicana to please Eddie Belfour. And I had to leave that out because I told the Ray Emery story. But besides that, all of the stories are in there. Before I forget, one more embarrassing book relay story. So one of the guys, speaking of signing autographs, So Connor McDavid happens to live 5 minutes from me. And so I wrote Jeff, his agent, and just said, you know, I'll get a copy to Connor. I'll just drop it off in his mailbox or whatever. And so I go to his house and there's nobody home. And I just leave it on sort of leaning up against a wall on a kind of uncovered porch. Mm-hmm. And because I wasn't going to ring the doorbell and bug Connor McDavid anyway. Hey, it's James. Here's your book. So then I go home and I'm, you know, watching SportsCenter and I realize that Connor McDavid is in Arizona, which I should have known, but I didn't
right.
know.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, okay. So I text Jeff, his agent, and said, is Connor's girlfriend at the house? And he's going, no, she's in Edmonton still. So, and then I look outside and it's pouring rain. And I've realized I've left this book outside. This is the next day now. And there's nobody living at Connor McDavid's house. And his book is just getting destroyed in the rain. sitting on it. And so McDavid's probably home. I don't know if he's back in Aurora, if he went straight to Edmonton or whatever. But somewhere like outside Connor McDavid's house is this wiltering copy of Beauties being destroyed in the rain and the pelting snow for the last week. And I don't have the courage to go back and, you know, sheepishly walk up his steps and take it away.
Well, I was going to say, that would be the great follow-up where you go to retrieve it and get busted stealing things from Connor right. McDavid's house.
Right. One of those doorbell cameras alerts yeah. them that I'm back. One of the jerks stealing a package from the front door.
Oh my gosh. I got to, like, I'm going to say, these are such good stories. I don't want to, like, you know, spoil the reader's surprise too much mm-hmm. here. The one that gave me, like I was reading it and literally getting sweaty palms was Dreger accidentally breaking the John Michael Lyles trade. Like that's my nightmare. Like that is my, right. like I'm placing my trust. Like I'm, you know, Brian Burke is giving me the trust. I worry about that all the time, that something's going to happen where
right.
I'm going to like betray a source, not on purpose. Like I have nightmares.
About I think for guys like Dregs and yourself and the Bobby Max of the world, they, that would be your nightmare. That's why I try to avoid breaking stories at all costs. But for your listeners, I don't mind saying that one. Like I did want in the book, I wanted a big wide spectrum of hockey. I just did not want this to be hockey stories and not just funny stories from the dressing room. There's a ton of those. But I wanted there to be referees. So there's referee stories and agents and parents and coaches. And I wanted there to be some broadcaster stories. And so I had Dregs, and Bob's is more of a hockey story, but the story you're talking about, Dregs at the draft 1 year, Berkey told him in confidence they were getting John Michael Lyles, they hadn't notified the player or anyone, so he had to hold on to it for an hour, which happens a lot in this business with insiders, again, with your sources and trust with your sources. So Dregs agreed to wait. This is in the hours before the draft, and Dregs typed a draft email in his folder. And as he finished typing the draft, he was running up the stairs to go talk to Bob and sort of tripped, and the phone went out and fell across the room. And Dregs just picked up the phone, and the phone was fine and kept on going with his life, and checked the phone 15 minutes later and realized that when he had dropped the phone, it had sent the email, and TSN Hockey had sent it out and tweeted it, and it was suddenly everywhere. And the panic, you know, that second of panic when you realize you have broken a source's trust. Dregs tells it much better than I'm telling it right now. And having to walk across the floor and face Berkey a couple of hours
later. Of all people, too. Like, Berkey's, yeah. you know, there's a chance there's a scene yeah. on the draft floor. Like, he's there's a right hook from right. it.
And Berkey was pretty good about it in the end, I think. So Dregs got off the hook there. But I feel your pain on those. It's the worst. I have, since I don't break a lot of stories as a host, for me, it's posting videos by mistake or something on Twitter. And this happened to me last week where I guess I have not used the Twitter story function yet, where you can post a story, but somehow I pocket tweet storied a video of myself golfing in my basement. And if it wasn't for Ray Ferraro, who had to instantly email me and chirp me, and or text me and say, you know, why are you posting this video? And thankfully, there's not much salacious on my phone because I'm basically do golf videos, but it's basically me in my sweatpants in the basement, like hitting golf balls, and it could have been much worse. So I'm very paranoid of tweeting or Instagramming something completely by mistake.
How often do you check how well your... I love the James Duthie Brian Burke rivalry. Do you check how well your book is doing against his often in the bestseller list?
I'd be lying if I say I didn't check it. The bestseller list comes out every week. So Burke is very funny. The first week, I guess, when the books were out and they were... I think his was second and mine was fourth or something. He just sent me a text with a screenshot of the things. And so then mine passed him for a couple of weeks and I was sending him screenshots back and forth. And yeah, we're very juvenile on that.
Yes, of course. I can only imagine. Roberto Luongo does the foreword, and that's another, like, it's funny, like the relationships of the people you connect together. That's another guy I connect with you for some reason. And so I wasn't surprised to see that, like going back to the Olympics and, you know, the bits you guys would do. When did you start to form that relationship with Roberto? That kind of, you know,
right.
I think that showed his side that we didn't know existed. Like his public persona completely shifted at some point.
I'm not sure that there's been anybody in hockey from that perspective whose people, you know, people's general opinion of the guy outside of hockey has changed more over time than his, where he's now one of the most beloved figures in hockey. And I would say most of that is complete. First of all of that's from him. Most of it's from his Twitter account. I'd like to take a small credit for some of the bits he did for TSN as well. So I didn't know him at all. And I kind of had the same perception I think a lot of people did, that he was sort of quiet, a little bit aloof maybe. And I was asked maybe a decade ago by my boss to do a serious feature about backup goaltenders. They wanted a serious look at what it's like to be a guy who only plays 10 or 12 games a year. And we chose Jamie McLennan because I think, you know, he'd been thinking about getting into broadcasting. His career was almost over, so he was an easy guy to approach. And in the 2 weeks or so between getting assigned the story and going to do it, I decided to change it and make it into something completely different, which was a complete kind of joke of a story about how a backup, I thought to myself, backups, they must hate the starter because they have the job that guy wants. And so I came up with this idea of Luongo being a real jerk who used McLennan as a slave. And McLennan was quietly seething inside and wanted to get rid of Luongo and ends up driving over him with a Zamboni in a dream sequence. It's just really stupid television. But that was the first time I met him. We showed up in Florida, and the first scene we had to film was the getting run over by a Zamboni. And so it was the end of practice, and Luongo was coming off. And as he's coming off the ice, I had to stop him and say, "Hey, Roberto, it's James. I know Noodles talked to you about this. We're going to film the scene now where we run over you with the Zamboni." And he's like, "Yeah, no problem." And he was so good. And right away when we started filming this bit, he started coming up with ideas. And I think the relationship just went from there. And then he got traded to Vancouver. And he would text me and say, "Hey, why don't we do a story on this?" Like when, and the one I think was the greatest in my, not the greatest story, but when the Luongo Schneider thing was happening in Vancouver, there was a lot of tension there, right? About who should be the guy. And he texts me in the middle of all this and says, "Why don't we do a fun piece about us battling to be number one and having this incredible rivalry?" And so we went and shot this complete silliness of them all, you know, going back and forth on each other. I think you can find it on YouTube. And for him, and I think that was a great piece because everyone thought, "Oh, these guys must hate each other battling for number one." And instead they were close friends who sort of gave a big wink to the entire controversy of the situation. And I think that just shows, you know, Luongo's incredible sense of humor. So the bits that we've done with him are some of my favorite bits that I've done at TSN. And he's one of the, I'm not really friends with a lot of NHL players, frankly, but he's one guy who I've gotten to know really well because of those things. And I just think he is exactly what you think he, like, if you love his persona as Strombone or whatever, that's exactly what he's like. He's just a really good guy with a great sense of humor. And so I'm really happy that everybody loves him the way I loved him when we did that first story.
You know, he's always been interesting to me because it makes me wonder how many players in the past, I think, and I would take responsibility, like there's a feeling within the media of maybe getting players to open up or really conveying how they are. But I'm sitting there going, had it not been for social media or these other outlets, we would still think of Roberto Luongo as maybe this aloof, you know, guy that, that's how he was painted early on in his career. And I'm sitting there going, like, how off have we been on, as a, you know, media through the years on players, right? Without having this outlet for them.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny in a way that I think that more players haven't used it. And, you know, maybe Roberto's a unique circumstance because he has such a great sense of humor. But I know even from writing this book, there are other guys that have great senses of humor and are still maybe reluctant to use it. There's a lot of players that, you know, post videos of working out and such. But
right.
I think that that's probably one place where guys could be guys out there that probably could use the medium more. I don't know that there's anyone that has been as successful of showing another side of himself as Roberto has.
Well, no, I mean, and the bottom line is he's a unique person. Like he's legitimately funny. Like there's like, he's not just, you know, chirping or whatever. Like he's like, he is a, like a comic mind. Like he does. Well, stuff.
But it's he's so self-deprecating. Right. And that's, yeah, right. I think that's what I think people love in an age when, you know, there's not a lot of, I think probably in hockey more than anywhere else, you get it. But in a lot of other sports, there's not a lot of self-deprecating superstar athletes. And
yeah,
I think that's what the, that's where the charm lies more than anything else. Right.
Yeah. My favorite moment with Roberto Luongo was he covering 2010 Olympics, beats the Americans. So as an American, I didn't love that portion of it. But flying out of Vancouver, I happened to be at a gate next to him and his family. And I love that there was a photo in your book of him and his family celebrating the gold together. But to see this big group and just to see the joy, that moment and that, and to kind of see it behind the scenes, right? Like you see maybe what you wouldn't otherwise with this guy who had been kind of maligned and people wondered if he could win the big game. And there was all these questions about him. And I'm like, and now he gets to have this. I love that.
And it's the vulnerability. And that's what, again, I was really happy with that he shared in that story. There's two Roberto chapters in the book. The foreword, which is just about that time he had some stomach issues, let's say, in that overtime game against Anaheim, which he goes into vivid detail about in a hilarious way. But I did want a serious story from him. And so one of the last chapters is about that 2010 gold medal win for Canada. And, you know, he talked about the moment after, I think it was after Brodeur had a particularly bad game, maybe the third game. And they were riding on the bus and Babcock sent him a text and said, come to the front of the bus when everybody else gets off. And he kind of figured what that was about and waited till everyone got off the bus and went to Babcock. And Babcock said, you're the guy from here on in. And instead of, you know, the cocky, okay, this is my time, he felt sick to his stomach and said he wanted to throw up. And for an athlete to be vulnerable like that and tell us all that, you know, he wasn't super confident, he was terrified. And terrified really for the rest of the tournament until they won the gold medal. I think that's an endearing quality. And I wish more players would talk that way, talk about their insecurities.
Because that's how I would be. If, like, in Canada, the biggest, everybody in the world is watching, and now you have to replace a Hall of Fame. Like, the upside there is so small. You know what I mean? Like, like at that time, Canada wasn't, at that point, you maybe wasn't even the favorite. And it's like, oh, okay, now it's on you, Roberto. Best of luck. I'd be terrified too.
I think they all have that self-doubt. And I think that's what drives people. It drives all of us, right? The fear of, a fear of failure is what drives all of us to work hard. But I don't think many athletes admit it, right? Mm. They just say, oh yeah, no, I knew, you know, I knew we were going to win, blah, blah, blah. And he didn't. And was terrified right till the end until they won that gold medal. I mean, there's confidence within the game, right? But it was the moments before the game and such where you are filled with all that self-doubt you've had. And I love when an athlete reveals that.
Yeah, that's great.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep. You heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right. So one thing, James, in doing some research kind of beyond the book and in about you and watching some videos is I came across some clips from you and your daughter Gracie going to Ethiopia that I just didn't know existed. And I'm like, well, that's what an incredible story that is. What inspired that trip?
I think, Craig, a few years ago, I guess 6 or 7 years ago, I was looking for a way to give back. You know, we've donated to charities like everything else, but I felt like I hadn't done anything of any sort of significance. And secondly, and more selfishly, I wanted my kids to do something. You know, they're typical kids living out, you know, in a nice life, in a nice community outside of Toronto, and hadn't really experienced anything of what the world was really like. And Children Believe, which is the organization, approached me. And, you know, I'd seen some videos before, those commercials that are sort of sappy and make you feel so sad. And I didn't want to do those. And I made it clear to them, I don't want to do that. I don't want, you know, to be holding the sick child with the flies around. I appreciate the causes there, but I just didn't want to be part of that. I wanted to do something positive. And they said, okay, that's fine. Let's go do some trips and show you what we've done, right? Show you the schools we've built and the water supplies and wells we've built. And I took each one of my three kids when they were in grade 10. My last one, sorry, waited until grade 11, but to three different places where Children Believe does work. So my son and I went to Paraguay, and my eldest daughter and I went to Nicaragua, and my youngest daughter and I went to Ethiopia last January, just before the pandemic hit. And we actually sponsor two kids, so one in Paraguay, which my son and I met, and a little girl in Ethiopia. So that was the coolest part is, you know, people through all these various organizations, you can sponsor a child, but to be able to meet that child, to go to the town and go to her house and meet her and, you know, see the help that you're getting was a really cool experience. So we spent a week in Ethiopia doing that, shooting various videos. And I can honestly say one of the great experiences of my life, because to be able to do that, incredibly difficult, by the way, like to see that level of poverty, and you imagine a grade 10 or 11, a 16-year-old who's lived a perfect life in Canada, getting to see poverty at levels you wouldn't even fathom to understand. I mean, this family where we sponsored the little girl, it was the single mom with five kids in a house that essentially was a shack, maybe 9 feet by 9 feet, mud floor, nothing else. A couple of goats, their only income. So it was just, and yet they're happy. Like these kids, we went to the schools and such, they're happy. And you wonder how, you know, in our world and the way we live, how do you find happiness there? Because they don't know, right? They don't know what they don't have, and they're just happy to get up and have a meal every day. And so anyway, just, I really did see legitimate changes in my kids because of this. I think that they understood, you know, where Canada was in the world and how lucky they are to have what they have in this country. And so it was incredibly worthwhile. And it was trips of a lifetime, really.
It's interesting because, like you said, we've seen the commercials. You know, my family and I have sponsored kids. But I think when you're just sending the check or even I'm doing even less work, it's on autopilot, you don't. It feels like it's almost not even real, you know, like you have a name and a kid or whatever, but it seems like it's in another
right existence. And you know what, it's still okay though, right? You're still doing a great thing. But I understand what you mean 100%. And that was, like I said, that was the to see, you know, what our money had done. You know, in this case, I think just before we left, we threw in some extra money and bought them two goats and three chickens. Okay, which, you know, again, how do you wrap your head around that in North America? But for them, two goats and three chickens, okay, suddenly they're, you know, they're selling eggs at the market and the goats are reproducing and you can turn two goats into 10 goats and sell those goats. And you can suddenly create a livelihood for a woman who didn't have a livelihood. And now the kids can go to school and so on and so forth. So it was, it was really, really cool to see.
It's interesting because I had Bob McKenzie on and we were talking, you know, about raising kids in this time and, you know, or even just because we both had kind of similar blue collar upbringings, mm-hmm. and now, you know, he's raising his boys as, you know, Bob McKenzie, right? And that comes with its own set of challenges. Like, what other things have you done to try to, like, okay, you know, this isn't normal the way we live, right, for the most part?
I think, you know what, I live a really sort of quiet life. Yeah. I'm a pretty boring guy, and they don't – I live in Aurora, north of Toronto. There's no, I don't think, real massive wow factor with their friends or anything about what I do or anything like that. Right. I think, you know, in my early years, it was fun. You know, when my son was – I can remember – you know, him being, I don't know, 8 or 7 or 8 and taking him to the World Juniors in Ottawa when Tavares and Pique and all those guys were on the team. And I think they signed a program for him. And I can remember him, like, he had no concept that this wasn't whatever he was, like, he was in the dressing room or whatever. And, hey, that was kind of fun. And I'm like, son, like, you have no idea. But I don't think beyond that, I think they just, and I think that's one thing I'm proud of, that both my wife and I have done a good job, that they don't think anything besides I have a few books out, and my family's not a sports obsessed family. TSN is not on a lot in our house unless I'm watching it in the basement. So I think they're pretty normal. And besides the fact they love going to the World Juniors at Christmas time and they think that's pretty cool. I don't think there's, they don't sit around. There's never any of them go, hey, my dad's on TSN. I don't think that's ever happened before. Cause I don't think they really care. I think they're more embarrassed by me than anything else half the time.
Yeah. That sounds about right. Yeah. Your family and your kids are always the least impressed with anything.
Oh,
I'm not even sure my 100%. Kids know what I do, to be honest. They're like, what do you, you're in your office all day and what?
Well, exactly. My wife, she is the least sports fan. Like, you could not have married less of a sports fan than my wife. I tell these stories often, but there was a time a few years ago, you know, when I'm away at the Cup final, and I called her and said, was my son's graduation. He was graduating from grade 8, and so we didn't know if I would make it home. And I called her after the Blackhawks had come back and beaten the Bruins, and I said, honey, I'm going to make it. I'm going to be home. It's over. And she goes, I'm pretty sure there's one more round, isn't there? And I said, no, honey, there's no more rounds. And she goes, no, I'm pretty sure I read there was one more round. I'm like, honey, Jonathan Toews is 20 feet away from me with the Stanley Cup. There are no more rounds. And she goes, are you sure? I'm like, yes, I will be home tomorrow. So I think that's what, there's, like I said, there's not a lot of sports talk that goes on in the house.
One of my favorite moments, I remember when the Kings were beating the Devils in the Stanley Cup final, and it had been a long road for everybody. And in the clinching game, the Kings go up 3 or 4 goals early, mm-hmm. and Pierre LeBrun booked a flight back home in the middle of the game. And we were so mad at him for potentially jinxing us getting home to see our family. Like, we're like, Pierre, what? He's like, no, they got this. I've never been more mad at Pierre in my life.
Right, that was the major penalty or whatever by the Devils, right? And they scored 4 goals on the power play or something like that.
Gosh, yeah.
Yeah, that was a jinx city. And we also, I'll say, that same Stanley Cup final, Bob McKenzie and I broke every rule about no cheering in the press box because I think that probably the dirty little secret for a lot of guys who cover the playoffs is that people think that we're vested in, you know, who were you cheering for? Well, for the most part, we cheer for whoever wins game one to win games 2, 3, and 4 and get it over with so we can go home to our families, right? If you've been on the road for a long time, that's the reality for a lot of people. The fan in me would love to see game 7 every year, but the dad in me wants to get the hell home. And so that particular year, remember when Boston had the lead very late in that game and it looked like we were headed back to Chicago for a game 7 and that meant 3 more days on the road. And then the Hawks scored 2 goals in like a minute and won the game. And Bob and I were high-fiving so hard in the press box, breaking every rule possible because we were ready to go home.
I mean, I know. And I say this with a caveat, we have the best jobs in the world always.
100%.
There's no complaining. Love it. It's just that constant tug of war, right?
It's the reality of life, especially when you have kids and you're away from them for a long time. You're right. Like I love everything about what we do, but sometimes you just want to get home.
Yeah. Where'd you grow up?
So I was an RCMP kid. So in my younger years, I was everywhere. My dad kept getting transferred. I was born in Ottawa, moved to Edmonton as a child. We lived next to the family of Cliff Coral, who most of your listeners will probably be too young to remember, but was a Black Hawk who played in the Stan Mikita era. And that was where my sort of love for hockey came from, because when I was 4, 5, 6, 7, my dad would always talk about living next to the Corals. So that was my first favorite player. And the Blackhawks were my first favorite team. Then we moved to Halifax. Then we moved to Victoria. And then finally back to Ottawa, where I spent most of my years in high school and university and such. So I moved around, sort of all Canadian boy as a kid. And Ottawa is my hometown for sure.
How do you think kind of the bouncing around impacted you and kind of is your personality?
I was young, probably too young for it to impact too much on me, except I think I was a bit of a loner. If I was to try and get deep and psychological with you, I have two older sisters who were well older than me. And I think moving around in those ages before you're 10, 11, 12 years old, I spent a lot of time probably on my own. And I think I had a wild imagination. My mom used to say that, you know, she'd send me to my room and it was no punishment because she'd come back up 10 minutes later and I'd be, I don't know, playing with Lego or whatever and inventing some, you know, talking. I think I was doing play-by-play on whatever the heck I was talking about at like 5 years old. And so I think it probably spurned maybe creativity in me. I think I wasn't a real smart kid, but maybe I had a lot of weird stuff going on in my head, which probably ended up being the roots of those TSN pieces we've seen. And maybe my love of storytelling that I've gotten later on in life. So I suppose you could probably draw something to that I was alone a lot as a kid. But I don't, besides that, I had a pretty normal childhood.
What drew you to Carleton and studying journalism?
Well, it's funny. I was going to go, I had grand illusions of being a professional football player. And they were complete illusions. I got recruited by McGill. And I was going to go and play cornerback at McGill and take phys ed. And that was my plan in life. I was going to be a gym teacher and play 5 years of football at McGill. And I think at the last second, I sort of had this, I don't know, I had this moment where I realized I was, barely 5'10 and 160 mm-hmm. pounds with average speed and talent, and that the 49ers probably weren't looking for that, nor the CFL. And so I just kind of had a last minute change of heart and said, what could I do? I want to do something in sports. I'm not good enough to be an athlete. What would be the next best thing? And applied to some, anything with sports attached to it, sports marketing, sports administration, I think, at Laurentian, and journalism at Carleton, and got into journalism. So I said, let's try that instead.
Did you want to be forward facing, like camera, the whole time, or was that something that kind of evolved?
Probably was enough of, I wanted to be, I just knew I wanted to go to the games for free, essentially.
that was first and foremost.
I can't remember. I remember that there was my second year prof at Carleton, or third year, one of my first TV stories. I did a feature on one of the running backs at Carleton, a guy named Mark Brown. And I remember the teacher wrote on my evaluation, said, you're pretty good at this. You should think about a career in TV. And that, that was the first time I ever thought, oh, somebody besides, me thinks maybe I can do this for a living. And it's incredible how, a teacher can impact you that way, because that was just one line on a thing. And that was the first time I started thinking, okay, maybe I'll try to do television and maybe I'll try to be a sportscaster, and kind of went from there.
Did you have like a big break? Like, was there a moment where you were able to kind of change lanes to get where you had to get?
Well, that's a really complicated story, and
okay,
I'll tell you it quickly. I basically became a news reporter because there weren't jobs in sports when I got out of Carleton. I was hired by CJOH, the local station in Ottawa, at in my last year of school. I was really lucky. So I worked away in news trying to get a break in sports, but TSN was still in its infancy and there weren't any other sports networks and there just weren't jobs. Every station had two guys who'd been there forever. I did a couple of sportscasts. Carolyn Waldo was one of the sportscasters there, and she went on maternity leave a couple of times, the former synchronized swimmer. And so I did some sportscasts, but Brian Smith, the late Brian Smith, was the main sportscaster in Ottawa. And I don't know if you'd know this story even, Craig, but he was a schizophrenic, shot him in the head and killed Brian walking out of our station a day. I happened to be on vacation in Halifax. And obviously the most horrific, incomprehensible story that one could imagine, particularly in a town like Ottawa, right, which is just a safe, quiet, wonderful city. And at a place like CJOH, for this to happen to Brian, it made no sense. So I'd been out partying with some friends in Halifax and slept on somebody's couch, and they woke me up the next day and said, "You need to turn on the TV." And my boss called me a few minutes later and said, at this time Brian was in a coma, and said, "We need you to fly back and do the sports tonight at 6 o'clock because Bill, the other sportscaster, was too shaken up to do it." And so I took a flight back and got in a cab and learned on the news that Brian had passed away, and did the 6 o'clock sports that night. And the hardest thing I'll ever have to do in my career, and I suppose in some weird way made the rest of my career easier, because that was just beyond anything I could comprehend to sort of make my debut on the 6 o'clock sports in that fashion.
Right.
And did that sportscast and got through it, and then sat in the stairwell and bawled for about 45 minutes. Cause Brian wasn't, you know, I'd be exaggerating to say we were close friends, but he was a good friend. And I spent a lot of time hanging around in the back, listening to Brian and Billy tell stories, cause they were just great, great guys. And that's when they offered me the position to go into sports full time and replace Brian. And, so that was, needless to say, the worst possible way you could ever get the break you wanted your entire life.
My goodness.
And I did it for a year and a half, and it was among the best year and a half of my life, because Billy and I were best friends and Carolyn was great, and had a great time, but never felt right doing it, because it just, again, it's all I wanted to do, and then for it to happen that way. So I ended up leaving. I took a news job in Vancouver just because I just needed to leave. And TSN ended up calling me 6 months after I took the job in Vancouver. So sorry to be long-winded on that story.
No, that's
a little more complicated than your typical breaks in the business.
What do you think you learned from Brian? And maybe it's from what was watching him, or just from those stories in the office.
Well, I think both those guys, and you know, it's funny, Billy, I think, was probably among the most proudest when I made it to TSN, because he sort of he never had a son, and sort of adopted me that way and taught me the ways when I got into sports. And Billy passed away of a heart attack during my first year at TSN. I think he really, going back to replacing Brian, he really, you know, he was the guy who did the 11:30 and was really comfortable doing it. And I think the pressure of being the 6 o'clock guy got to him and took a toll on him. But both those guys, I think what they taught me first of all was the value of a story, because the local newscast back then, unfortunately sports has died at so many local newscasts, but the local newscast, particularly at CTV in Ottawa, was about telling stories. They would do a high school athlete of the week and a senior of the week. And so they taught me that high school athlete of the week, or that 90-year-old cross-country skier we were doing the profile on, was just as important as doing the profile on, you know, Alexi Yashin playing for the Ottawa Senators those days. And I think they really burnt that into me, that every story, you just don't just think about, you know, doing the elite athletes or whatever, that every story you can tell is just as important, and the stories you can tell about people that aren't known are just as valuable. So that was the lesson I think that Brian and Bill taught me. The other thing I remember Bill used to always say to me, when I got on TSN, I was prone to doing too much of the yuck yucks, hosting SportsCenter. And I can remember Billy calling me and saying, and his example was always, if Muhammad Ali, who was still alive at the time, you know, dies in a plane crash, you need to go on there and people need to take you seriously. And so you need to balance the attempts at humor with credibility. And that always sort of stuck with me. And I think from then on, you know, if I was doing 10 intros on a show, I'd try to make, you know, one kind of funny and mm-hmm. eight or nine more serious and not balanced. So those two guys taught me a heck of a lot, is a long-winded way of saying that.
Yeah. Why do you think you kind of the pressure, I'm sure you're dealing with it in different ways, but why do you think you've succeeded to kind of block that out and do what you're able to do?
I think that my years in news are part of the reason that I do think spending 8 years as a news reporter, you do realize sports' place in the world. And I think something like COVID has also taught us all that. If we look at, I don't want to use the word perspective because I hate when we use that, you know, when something happens. So that puts everything in perspective. But it is an escape. And it is, you know, something that people do to get away from everything else in their everyday lives. That doesn't mean we don't take it seriously and treat it seriously. And we should, because a lot of people care about it and they're big money industries. But always to remember that it's not the end of the world. And I think that somehow that was probably ingrained in me with my years in news. And that, okay, if I screw up really badly on TV, which I've done numerous times, that it sucks and you're going to be mad at yourself for a couple of days and you might get people laughing at you on Twitter, but in the end, does it really, you know, it's not that big of a deal. And I think that probably helped me along the way. Always, you know, again, treat it with respect and treat the fans with respect, but always remember that you're talking about a hockey game or something. And I think, again, this is a lot of self-observation that I probably haven't done in my life, but I think that's probably helped me be relaxed and be myself on TV.
Yeah, I think that's great perspective, and I think your attraction to storytellers, like just to bring this all full circle, like this to storytelling and storytellers. Mm-hmm. I mean, that comes across right in this book. Like you said, you're telling Connor McDavid and Sidney Crosby, but you're telling anybody who has a good story that can connect people. There's value that people like that, and I think that comes across in the book.
Well, thank you for saying that. And I think that's, you know, I think there's something special, and I don't think I'm going to be preaching to the converted here with you because it's what you do.
Yeah.
But there is something about hockey and stories, I think, more than other sports. And I don't know what it is about hockey, whether it's just the nature of the game, the toughness of the players, that lends itself to great stories more than other sports. I really feel that way. And as I said when we started the interview, I honestly think you could take every player in the NHL and each one of them probably has, you know, a handful of great stories if you can get it out of them, right? It's something about the nature of the player and the road trips and everything else that it lends itself to this more than other sports. And so it's a true pleasure to be able to tell a few of them.
Awesome. Well, the book, again, is Beauties, Hockey's Greatest Untold Stories. It's awesome. I'm glad to see it successful, even if it means it's made your life a little harder in sharing copies with those who helped you. But James, congratulations, and thanks a lot for doing this.
Oh, thank you so much. And let Connor McDavid know that I'm sorry about the wilted, rain-covered, snow-covered, frozen copy of his book that is sitting on his doorstep.
If you need me to send my copy over to Connor, just let me know.
Please do. Thank you, Craig.
Thanks, James.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
want to thank James Duthie for joining the podcast. It was just some incredible stories. That was fun to talk to James. I would encourage you to check out his book, Beauties, Hockey's Greatest Untold Stories. Probably makes a great gift. And hopefully it's not sold out. I mean, hopefully for him it's sold out in bookstores, but for your sake, I hope you're able to find it. Or if not, you can try to find the stranded Connor McDavid version that's somewhere in a doorstep. So thanks again to James for joining the podcast. I thoroughly enjoyed that conversation. A couple things before we wrap up. Pat Brisson of CAA joined Scott Burnside and Pierre LeBrun this weekend, two-man advantage. Pat is great. A great storyteller, represents guys like Sidney Crosby, Jonathan Toews, Matt Barzal, Patrick Kane. I mean, just a long list of superstars. So Pat is always an interesting conversation. And while you're at it, if you enjoy it, Pat was on the Full 60, oh man, about a year ago, and was great talking about how he became an agent. So if you want to go through the archives and check that out, I would encourage that as well. And the other thing, if you haven't read Mike Russo's story on Mark Parrish at The Athletic, I would encourage you to check it out. It talks about how he finally got help for his struggle with alcoholism. And Mark joined Mike Russo on Straight from the Source. And that's Mike's podcast. If you're not a Wild fan or you haven't listened to it, check that out. Great story to read and great companion podcast with Mike and Mark. So definitely check that out. Last thing, if you have a second, you want to give me a holiday gift, the best thing you can do would be go to Apple Podcasts. Review this podcast, leave a review. It helps me out, and I would greatly appreciate it. So do that if you have a second. Otherwise, thanks a lot for listening. I hope you're able to enjoy the last couple of weeks of 2020. Enjoy the holiday season. Thank you so much for everything. Take care.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.